There was, I read an article around the time that Pokemon Go was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little spike of people naming their babies after Pokemon. I mean, there's not a lot of acceptable Pokemon names, but I guess Staryu is probably okay. Eevee.
Snorlax.
Obviously.
Geodude.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host Keith Foster from Santiago.
That's right. What's up, Jabber Jaws and Drone Strikes? It's me, Keith, and I'm here with my co-host from Los Angeles, Cassidy Robinson.
Mm-hmm. And we're still trying to get this dog and pony act going. Without a laptop.
Yeah.
On my end.
Oh, I see. I thought you were just going to say that we're basically bi-weekly at this point.
Right. I mean, yeah, we've kind of settled into that. Eventually at some point when both of our schedules are kind of normal again, maybe we'll get back into a weekly schedule.
Yeah, it might be after April. I was looking at the movie releases coming up in April, and it's just woof.
Right. I mean, that's a weird thing. It's like now, you know, summer season used to start around April, around the time of, like, the first day of summer hits, and now it's moving back further and further. So they start to, they have these, March has become this really big, like, testing ground month, where if they have a franchise they think could stick, they test it out in March, right after February, because they know that everyone pretty much avoided the movies for the first part of the year. So then they hit you hard on March with all these kind of, like, new ideas. Or, like, you know, maybe it's Marvel and they're trying out one of their new superheroes or something.
Speaking of, I know we're kind of foregoing movie news because we're doing a different thing this week.
Right.
I don't even know if I should bring it up. Have you heard about I think it's Sony. I don't know. One of the movie studios has talked about making a rated R Venom cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, that has been in the works for a while. Marvel took back Spider-Man, and they kind of deal.
That kind of put a pause on it. It's just that now that Logan proved that Deadpool wasn't just a fluke, and you can, in fact, have a successful rated R movie, I'm like, ugh, just...
That's a new thing. And there's going to be a big flurry of, like, inappropriately R-rated superhero movies. And by inappropriate, I don't mean, like, naughty. I mean, like, movies that have no business being R-rated.
Yeah, we're going to get, like, the first R-rated...
Shatterstar movie.
Yeah, that's not the worst thing ever. I just don't care.
Ugh. So that we don't keep talking about that, I did have something I wanted to ask you. I read an article, I think it was the AV Club, who asked their staff if there's anything that would be a pop culture deal breaker if you were to start to become friends with somebody or if you're starting a new relationship, you know, if you found out they were into X, would that be a deal breaker? And I wanted to run this by you as kind of a test, because I actually tried to think about that for a while, and I was like, I'm not really the type that just, you know, we're from Idaho. So it was really difficult to find anybody who had even a semblance of decent taste in anything in a cultural dead zone. So I had to learn how to like weed through, you know, their terrible pop culture choices to find the human being to appreciate. But I did think of something.
Oh, okay.
But I wanted to posit that to you. Of course, obviously you're married, so it wouldn't be like a relationship thing, maybe per se, unless you know your wife, like God forbid, fell down like a elevator shaft or something.
I like that you've thought of like the most gruesome possible end. So you say pop culture,
right? So movie, film, music. You know, is there like a, or even like, I guess, kind of like entertainment thing? Like maybe this person's super into country line dancing. I don't know.
I don't know if there'd be I think the only deal breaker I could think of is if they had a deal breaker. I'm married. I don't need these hypotheticals.
What if somebody was a juggalo? Could you like possibly like mate and you didn't know at first it was like coworker or something, you find out they're a juggalo when you like are hanging out?
Yeah, I think I'd be too interested.
You just have to know.
There's a whole culture there. Like that's I would just mm-hmm. be curious. Like I would want to see pictures of them in their makeup. I would I've heard that there's like this ongoing sort of story arc with the like something about the, we might have talked about it on this podcast before, I don't know, something uh-huh. about like the Jester albums foresee the end of the world or something. I don't know, there's just a whole, like that'd be too interesting. No, I can't really think of anything, but I'll think about it. Tell me what yours would be.
And I agree with you on most fronts. I've been friends with lots of people who are into all sorts of dumb things or whatever.
Thing is that there's probably, you know, plenty of people that think the stuff I'm into is dumb, and it's like, okay.
Sure, yeah. Like, you know.
Used to watch Dragon Ball Z, I get it.
Yeah, I don't think that's that deal-breakery, but anymore, that's like, makes you more cool.
It's like everyone just was like, you know what, we don't have to be ashamed of stuff we think is cool anymore.
Right. Next week, if we end up reviewing Power Rangers, I'm sure that'll be a big part of the conversation.
Oof, yeah, we'll see.
the thing I came up with for the answer for this question was I couldn't really be friends or very good friends or be in a relationship with anybody who's like super into that like Faces of Death stuff.
Oh, that's a good one.
And or anything kind of in that vein, like they like watching videos of people like getting like really badly hurt or something like that, or like epic like, fail videos and that kind of stuff.
Well, you know,
there's like a difference between like the America's Funniest Home Video, like a guy like is trying to like do a wire walk and like falls on his balls or something.
That's eternally funny.
But like bum fights and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I wasn't even thinking of stuff like that, just because that's so niche. Like, I guess that counts. Yeah, I wouldn't be super into that, but I don't know. I don't want to judge people if they're into bum fights or Faces of Death. Like, I think it's disgusting, but, you know, if they're a totally pleasant person despite that, and they're not, like, always trying to make me watch it, whatever, like...
Yeah, maybe it's not even necessarily a deal breaker, but it would be, I would count it as a red flag. I would be like, I don't like that about you.
Well, shit, I count Fox News as a red flag. Like,
yeah, that was somebody's answer on the article. But to me, that almost doesn't count because that's not, I don't know. I mean, it is, like, is that entertainment? That's more just like somebody willfully undergoing propaganda.
Like, yeah, I guess in the case of something...
That's more has to do with ideology.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to break your brain.
This is not the podcast for these hard-hitting questions. I thought...
No.
God, this is going to be, do we like Disney movies?
Right, right. That was what we're going to... Today we're going to be reviewing Beauty and the Beast, and at the end of the program we're going to review in the Netflix homework Cleopatra, which you assigned me. But because we're reviewing Beauty and the Beast, I thought it would be fun to talk about our favorite Disney movies, or just talk about the Disney animated features, not Pixar, because me and Richard covered that back around, Inside Out. We did a kind of one of these for that.
Oh, I see. I see how it is.
Yeah. You know, you get all the ideas we haven't covered in whatever it was, 180 episodes. So we're going to be talking about the best, the worst, the most underrated, and the most overrated are our choices for Disney animated or Disney animation proper.
Yes.
And I'm trying to think of what order we should do this in. Let's start with underrated. Do you want to go first?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the reason I picked it as underrated is because it feels like it's almost entirely erased from Disney canon. Like, you won't ever see this at, like, Disneyland or things like that. It's a shame. But my pick for most underrated is The Great Mouse Detective. It was pulling off Sherlock before this Sherlockessence we've had in the last few years. The Adventures of Basil in Baker Street.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes on the Vicious Radigan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's one that Ashley and I like to watch. And I just think it doesn't get enough credit for being a fun anthropomorphic detective story. It's sort of like feels like it could have been a Rescuers movie, but mm-hmm. it's not.
Yeah, well, it is a period piece as well.
Yeah, it's sort of bizarre for them.
It kind of feels like their answer to An American Tale. Do we know which one came out first?
Ooh, no, but we can find out. So The Great Mouse Detective came out in 1986?
Yeah, I figured around then.
An American Tale also came out in 1986.
There you go. Well,
that can't be right. Yes? Yeah, 5-0 Goes West was 91. If we're comparing the two... I can't even tell you what happens in the original American Tale. I just really? Remember some of the songs. Yeah, I can't. I know the Somewhere Is Out There song and the No Cats in America song, but that is like, I haven't seen that movie in forever. I definitely watched 5-0 Goes West more, but.
Right. I definitely watched American Tale. I had it on VHS when I was a kid, and I definitely watched that more than I watched The Great Mouse Detective. But I agree with you. The Great Mouse Detective is really good, and I actually have that as, like, one of my, like, standbys on underrated. And when I'm looking at my underrated list, it's all that stuff between, like, the heyday of the, like, 60s-ish, and then, like, the Katzenberg Eisner era, that like the post Little Mermaid.
I know what
specifically
you mean.
The 80s stuff, it's a little darker, it's a little bit more like Disney animation in general was still trying to get back on sea legs again.
Yes.
And my pick for that, my official pick for underrated, was Brave Little Toaster, but I feel like that has a pretty strong cult following.
Is that Disney?
Yeah.
I mean, they played it on the Disney Channel, but I didn't know it was, like, Disney.
Yeah, that's Disney. Hey, Jabber fans. So I'm looking up this information because I was editing the episode, and I figured before I so confidently post this pick here for my underrated film, it's Brave Little Toaster, come to find out this is not technically a Disney film, but... film was greenlit by Disney Studios, but they later rejected the pitch from John Lasseter. John Lasseter and Glenn Keane, and they took the pitch elsewhere to Hyperion Pictures, who later made the film. It looks like Disney maybe released the DVD, because I think the DVD that I have was distributed through Disney Animation, but yes, the film was not technically a Disney release, Thus, I will change my answer to best underrated film to The Rescuers Down Under, for the sake of consistency here. All right, back to the show.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great movie.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up basically using the skeletal plot of that to tell Toy Story 3.
Yeah, and basically every DreamWorks movie that's come out since, like Storks and Boss Baby. And like, if you look at the trailer for Boss Baby, which, why would you? it's literally just Toy Story with babies. Yeah. A Pet's Life is just Toy Story with pets.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. The Brave Little Toaster. I almost said the Rave Little Boaster. It's just a guy without a shirt on with some neon lights talking about how cool he is. that movie should not happen.
Okay, let's go with overrated. Is the most overrated Disney animated feature?
This one was really tough for me. Most of my picks are, like, the ones that even pop up into my head are like vintage Disney. Mm-hmm. I'm not, like, super into, like, 50s and 60s Disney. I mean, I don't know. There is, a weird nostalgia to them.
Yeah.
But I have to say one, so this might be sacrilegious, but I'm going to say Snow White.
I almost put that. I'm kind of with you.
It's hard because I think a lot of the credit it gets is because it was the OG.
It was the first, yeah.
It founded everything, and I have to give respect to that. Mm-hmm. And so on that aspect, it's not overrated at all. But as a movie, it's just, I don't care for it. It's just like, to me, the animation's really old and kind of drab. The voice acting isn't the best. I don't know.
I haven't looked at it in quite a while, I should say. I haven't seen it since I was a kid. Yeah. But I think it is an achievement in animation, especially if you think about when it came out, which I think it was like the late 30s.
1937.
Yeah. So, you know, considering, like, looking at all animation that existed around that time and then looking at that movie, like, it's far and away the best animation that had been done at that point.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what I mean. Like, I feel bad saying
it. And it has kind of a very minimalist style. Like, there isn't a lot of dialogue, as I remember. I think it's mostly kind of, there's some songs, but it kind of just sort of, it's almost sort of a silent film in a lot of ways. I like the witch, but yeah, I agree with you. Like, if you're looking at it as a story, it certainly doesn't have as deep of characters. It doesn't have a lot of things that we're kind of used to.
Specifically, the reason why I say it's overrated is because, again, I think I've mentioned this before, but me and Ashley have season passes to Disneyland, which is a far better investment than you realize. and I mean, Snow White is everywhere. And I get it, you know, they're paying their dues, but, you know, she's like one of the top princesses.
Right.
I think she has like some of the best, like, IP artwork. Like, you know, she just has a great color scheme.
Yeah.
And it gets used a lot. And I think as far as a movie goes, since then, Disney has only surpassed the achievement that they reached with Snow White. I think it's okay to acknowledge that it's kind of dated.
Sure, totally. But it's also very archetypal. But yes, no, I agree with you.
It's a weird one. And some hate mail for that.
Mine was, this was the easiest one for me. Almost so easy I didn't want to pick it. For me, it's Frozen with a bullet.
Oh, I thought we couldn't do CGI.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, any of, like any of the stuff that's not Pixar. Like, you know, Big Hero 6 and Wreck-It Ralph or whatever. That's all on the table. Bolt. Well, I never saw Bolt, but...
I'm pretty sure I said traditional animation, and you were like, yeah.
I just said Disney, and you asked me all eras.
I resoundingly agree with you.
How long has it been since you've seen, or how many times have you seen Frozen since the first time?
I only saw it once, and it was on an airplane.
Ooh, okay. I saw it in theater. I can see why people got swept up in it, because there's something about it that feels kind of like a Beauty and the Beast-ish type thing, or kind of like a Sleeping Beauty. Like, it has...
I'm so mad that this is your pick.
It has that sort of tone, and it captures that really well in the aesthetics of the movie. I think as a story, it's kind of a mess, and it kind of doesn't really make sense. Like, you know, Elsa gets kicked out of the castle because she feels different, but then she feels empowered because she's away.
No fucking white. I put it all on the line because I thought we were talking tradish and a mache. And you go fucking Frozen on me?
Well, am I wrong?
Fuck you. You're not wrong at all. But fuck you.
And also, you know, and I could have put this on my underrated list, but I didn't. For all the praise that Frozen gets for being like this new whatever in like female-fronted Disney animation, Tangled gets almost no love. And that movie, like, you know, was really set the stage for Frozen.
So a lot of Disney's animated, like CGI animated stuff, I haven't seen. I'm spotty on it. Yeah, so that takes sort of a lot off the table, which could have possibly made my list very easily. I don't think I saw a Disney movie from, like 2000 on till like, recently. So there's a huge chunk that I am not familiar with.
Yeah, there's a period of time when I used to watch them every year, and it was you made a point to go see them every year, kind of like how Pixar is now. There was a point at a certain age where I kind of like got more into, I guess, like boy stuff or like action movies and that kind of stuff, and I kind of waned on the Disney animated stuff. So even like stuff like Hercules, I've never seen.
Oh.
Even though that's kind of well loved or whatever. Every once in a while I would end up seeing one.
Hercules almost made my underrated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It has a fan base. But like, you know, especially some of the later stuff like Treasure Planet and that stuff I never saw.
Yeah, I never saw Treasure Planet. I never saw Atlantis, Brother Bear. Like, I have a list of Disney movies right here, and I'm just like, Tarzan, didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
I missed a huge chunk. Like, I think the last one I saw in theaters might have been Mulan until The Princess and the Frog.
Right, yeah. And then I did see that, and I saw some of the, and I've seen some of the CGI ones more lately because I've been reviewing them. But why don't you go ahead and now that you know everything that you're allowed to say, what is the worst Disney movie, Disney animated feature that you saw?
The worst. See, this is hard for me because I do think for the most part, Disney, you know, you are getting a certain level of quality. I mean, even their missteps are usually pretty good.
Mm-hmm. You're grading on their curve, so it, you know.
Yeah, I don't have a solid answer for worst, because they're all like, I get that maybe I don't know. I guess
it's a show business, not show friends.
Yeah. I think I know what your answer is.
I don't know.
Can I guess what your answer is?
No, I want you to hear what yours is.
I don't have one. So I'll take a stab at what I think yours is, and that'll be my pick. Because I wasn't super into it. But the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yep, samesies.
Yeah, but you know, that's... I haven't even seen this movie since it came out, so I really don't remember. It might not be... I remember I just wasn't super into it, but
mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean anything.
No, yeah, I mean, it was... The reason why I put it as my worst, other than it was one of the... This was sort of the reason I kind of stopped going to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or that I made an effort to go see them. Like, because I guess I was excited. I liked the story of The Hunchback of Notre Dame vaguely. I was a kid. I should have, like, been able... I was pretty easy to please back then. Like, you know, I was super into the Double Dragon movie. It should have been easy to, like, to cross that barrier. But I remember seeing it and just being like, eh... And, like, and the more I think about it, like, now, thinking about it, I think about a lot of, like, the character dynamics and, like, what's going on with the script and stuff. And a lot of it's just kind of cannibalizing most of the script ideas from Beauty and the Beast. Like, they were really trying to recreate the success of Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, and I guess so.
I remember thinking it was kind of unnecessarily dark. Like, not dark in a, violent or like tragic way or something, but like there was like this, they were trying to make it more adult than I felt like I wanted to see at the time.
See, I think that one of the things that bothered me about it was and you know, it's not like I'm a huge Victor Hugo fan, but I knew. So I mean, this story wasn't based off like an archetypal fairy tale. You know, this is based off of, like, a book, a work of literature. And I did know that the book had, like, a pretty dark, sad ending, where basically everyone dies. And, like, they totally, I guess you could say the Disneyfication of it, you know, where they make it a happy musical. And I think, like, deep down, that just kind of bothered me. But I don't even know why. It's not like I'm like super attached to the source material. It just felt like kidding up a story that's, you know, dark and shouldn't necessarily be kidded up. It's like taking, you know, Romeo and Juliet and making it a musical where they both live happily ever after. Like that just seems a little weird to me. But I don't totally know why.
Because I also remember it being very, very musically centered, but I don't remember any of the music from it.
Like, you know what? I think this bears rewatching.
Like, maybe it does.
Like, I know it's not on Netflix, and it might be a little harder to get access to it, but I think we should try to challenge ourselves to rewatch it.
Yeah, a part of me thinks I might appreciate it more now than I did then, but I don't know. Okay, so here it is, I guess. What is your contender for the best?
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, this like, was not a hard one to write. Like, of all of these, I had, like, the longest list for best.
Oh, yeah, I mean, again, it's like, which era do you pick from? But there's one, and, you know, maybe it's not best, but it's my favorite. And I think it's good enough to where it has to be my pick, I think. And that's Aladdin.
Wow. Okay. That's not what I thought you were going to say.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. When you're going best, the obvi contenders, obvi, are Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Little Mermaid, Lion King, you know, like,
that whole renaissance, that whole...
These are the heavy hitters. These are, like, each one of them is, you know,
Oscars. And specifically, those were the ones that we grew up with. Like, we were the exact right age when those movies came out.
And I just think that quality-wise, though, maybe it is just nostalgia blinders, but they stand out to me. They are, like, it's, you know, it's the best they've ever been, and I...
It was the high. It was probably the most they ever sold, too.
I think they just had such a hot streak going there. But yeah, Aladdin was always my favorite of those. So that's why I just kind of had to go with it.
It is also of that batch. It is the most explicitly a comedy. So maybe that's why you're more drawn to it than the others. I mean, you have the whole Robin Williams thing, but it's also like the music is like more kind of like it less Broadway and a little bit more kind of like Las Vegas showroom kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's just fun. It's a solid story. It's maybe it helps that this is the only one where the protagonist is a male prince, because usually mm-hmm. it is a princess, which mm-hmm. is fine. I think, you know, that's fine. Not saying anything there. It's just maybe I could relate to that a little more, especially during that time, you know, that age in my life.
Right.
You know, I could relate to Aladdin more. And mm-hmm. again, not saying that that's good or bad. I'm just saying that maybe that's why I connected. And, you know, my runner-up would probably be The Lion King.
Okay. Yeah. Under my list, I'll just give you my full list. My pick for the best, and I have Aladdin here under favorite, because I, for all the reasons you've already explicated, that is the one I watched the most. That's the only one of the bunch that had, like, a watchable Disney-related television series afterwards. which helped.
I watched a lot of those TV series, so I can't say much there.
So under that list, I had Aladdin. I also had The Jungle Book, which is really what I thought you were going to say.
I love me some Jungle Book, but I do mm-hmm. think it is a little more dated. And I just think you cannot ignore that heyday for Disney.
No, yeah, I agree. The Lion King is on here as well. The only reason I give my number one the edge over those, or specifically Lion King, is I think some of that Timon and Pumbaa stuff doesn't register as much when you get older. It's kind of dumb.
Okay.
And we'll be talking about the remake today. Beauty and the Beast, I gotta give it to them. I partly because of watching the remake, you know, kind of reminded me of how airtight that movie is. Like, you can't really move a single thing in and around it. Like, they workshop that screenplay down to to everything in there being essential. It has the best songs. If Howard Ashman, you know, his last musical score and songs that he wrote before he died. It has this big Broadway production show quality that I think really, really set the bar really high. I mean, they started with Little Mermaid, but I think Beauty and the Beast, like, fully realized that, and that, like, put them on this next level.
Yeah.
And it was also nominated for Best Picture alongside Silence of the Lambs, which mm-hmm. won in 1991. I want to say it was the first time animated film was nominated for Best Picture. And this was before there was an animated category.
This Beauty and the Beast was the reason they added an animated category, was because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that it got snubbed for Silence of the Lambs, and they, you know, it felt like it did deserve an award of some, you know, I think it got other awards. I don't know. Probably got best song or whatever, but
I'm sure it did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I thought that too, coming out of the remake. But then I was like, you know, is that just because it's so fresh and it's like, you know, I just watched it basically. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think maybe I turned away from it a little bit intentionally because of that. And I just,
fair enough.
I love Aladdin.
Yeah, no, I mean, if it's going to come down to it, if it's either watching Aladdin or watching Beauty and the Beast, I'll totally watch Aladdin. But I think that on a aesthetic and production quality, I think Beauty and the Beast is the superior film, despite my taste.
Yeah, I can see that. Sure.
Okay, well, that was fun. Before we talk about the other Beauty and the Beast movie that came out a couple weeks ago, I want to talk about this little cannibal film I saw called Raw.
We're going from Disney to indie cannibal movie to back to Disney.
back to Disney. It'll all make sense, I promise.
Well, I mean, it did lose, Beauty and the Beast did lose to Silence of the Lambs, so I guess there's...
There you go. Yeah, there's a connection there. Julia de Kernow's Raw was something of a festival shocker. There was all these stories, maybe some of them was developed by their PR people, who knows, but there was all these stories about coming out of the Toronto Film Festival and the other festivals that it was traveling around late 2016, of like people walking out, people being disgusted, people rushing to the bathroom, all of this stuff.
Okay.
So I'd been hearing about this movie since, like, I don't know, whenever the Toronto Film Festival was, so September or something. It is a movie about a cannibal, but it's one that's maybe not exactly like you've seen before. The basic story is there is a young girl named Justine, played by Garance Millar. It's a French/Belgian movie. And she grows up in this really strict vegan household where her parents, you know, the first scene you see in the movie is they're at some sort of buffet, and she takes a big bite of her mashed potatoes and accidentally bites into a meatball, and it becomes like a moment, like the mother's like, are you okay? And, you know, like, she's like, oh, I'm fine, and she's like spitting it out into a napkin and everything. So that's how they introduce this world. They're dropping her off to veterinary school, where she's going to learn how to take care of the animals. Her sister, her older sister, has been there a couple of years, and she's going to show her the ropes of how to, like, meet boys and go to parties and get drunk and pee outdoors and all of that stuff. There's hardcore hazing going on at this veterinary school. Like, they really go for it. In a way that you don't normally see depicted, I guess, in, like, foreign films, or at least I haven't. But I don't know. I guess that's not true. There's a lot of those, like, British boarding school movies that are pretty hardcore. Nevertheless, there's a lot of hazing going on here that deals with gross animal stuff and being, you know, blood being poured on them, Carrie style and that kind of stuff. And basically these underlings, these first-year students are being harassed throughout the entire movie. But then they also get to go off, you know, covering their blood-soaked scrubs to go to these crazy French vet school raves that happen every night. One of the hazing rituals she has to undergo is she has to eat a small rabbit's liver, I think. And she really doesn't want to, but her sister shows her that it can be done and basically forces her to do it. So she does, and then the next day has a rash all over her body. She's totally disgusted with herself. She has to go to a doctor and get, like, a cream. But this awakens something in her. And all of a sudden, now she's, you know, she's craving meat. She tries to steal a hamburger patty in the lunch line. And then is embarrassingly caught. Then she sneaks off into the middle of the night to eat raw chicken from the refrigerator. And when a waxing accident goes awry, she ends up maybe kind of sort of nibbling at the disembodied finger of her sister. And that pretty much kicks off into the rest of the movie. This is structurally, and you know, this is, I guess, something of an art film. And it's takes the subject matter pretty seriously. But this is kind of like a I Was a Teenage Werewolf kind of movie. Okay. Like, that's kind of how I kind of, like, they use a lot of the same tropes that you would see in, like, one of those, like, 60s exploitation, I Was a Teenage Blank. Except for they sort of, like, infuse that with the sort of the heart and sincerity of, like, a Molly Ringwald coming of age thing. And then it kind of goes for this hardcore, like, David Cronenberg body horror. And it does go there. It is fairly disgusting. There's a handful of scenes that were watched between the creases of my fingers. But it's really good. I'm not going to lie. This movie does everything it's trying to do, as disgusting as a lot of it is, really well. And I think what sells the body horror, gore, gross out stuff is the fact that it is a really pretty sincere and pretty well thought out character piece, first and foremost. And I think that, you know, the basically what, and the analogy that's being drawn here is female sexuality, with this raw meat eating cannibalism, and, you know, her sexual awakening sort of, and her sexual discovery sort of happens at the same time as she's craving human flesh. And I think, you know, there's something.
Raw dogs.
Oh, you don't even know. It goes there, and it's pretty hardcore. But I think that this is a really well made movie. I guess this is the director's first feature. She's a female director, and she's, you know, talking about a female character. So there is, I think, something of sort of a feminist subtext in all of this. And it really does come together. It's an effective horror film.
The funny thing is, like, based off of your description of the plot, I was not expecting you to say you liked this.
No, I kind of loved it. I would be very surprised if this isn't in my year-end list. All right. Would be very surprised.
Okay.
And it's, I don't know how easy it is to find right now. I think, it opened in L.A. and New York a few weeks ago and then trickled out a little bit more. But if you can stomach it, I would say go check it out. It's, okay. And it, you know, it's French and everything, but I think it's only 37 minutes long, and it's more story oriented and it's more character oriented. Doesn't get super crazy, abstracty weirdo. It does get super violent though.
Okay.
But yes, I liked Raw. Let's talk about another coming of age story.
Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
Yes. To sum this up. Did you see the cartoon? Then you know what it's about. So a young woman is in a farm town. She thinks that there's something more than living in a farm town. Her mom's dead. Her dad. I mean, come on. Do we really have to recap Beauty and the fucking Beast? It's a tale as old as time.
No, but we could talk a little bit about who's playing in this movie. Emma Watson is playing Belle.
Yeah,
your wife's lady, Emma Watson.
CGI rendered villain from Witcher 3 is playing the Beast.
Dan Stevens, I believe?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's in it for like 30 seconds, as the prince.
We have Luke Evans as Gaston, Josh Gad as LeFou. Whose role has been a little expanded, I think.
We've got, honestly, it's a pretty star-studded cast. Ewan McGregor as Lumiere. You've got Kevin Klein. Kevin Klein as Maurice, Belle's dad. I have a theory that every movie would be a little bit better with Kevin Klein in it. You have Sir Ian McKellen as Cogsworth, Emma Thompson, Mrs. Potts.
This is really difficult for me because I always confuse Emma Watson with Emma Thompson, and now they're in the same movie.
Oh, one's an older woman; the other is Hermione Granger. I don't know what there is to confuse.
I always just say the wrong one when I meant the other one.
Okay, I don't know how to help you with that. I guess let's just get into it. This is a pretty faithful adaptation of the cartoon. Like, they even have some of the goofy jokes from the cartoon. There's a couple of extra songs, which I found out are not from the Broadway production. So I'm like, where the fuck did these songs come from?
Alan Menken, I believe, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't about them. They didn't really add anything for me. I mean, basically, this movie just made me want to watch the cartoon. It was really just like... I mean, there was some stuff that I appreciated how much they revered the original, because as we were just discussing, it is an airtight movie. The original is and so I appreciated that they weren't like, we're just gonna go crazy and have these epic battles with Angelina Jolie for no reason and throw Johnny Depp in there with a Mad Hatter battle for no reason, and You know, even like the Cinderella remake tried to stick a little more to the original cartoon, but even it went a little cuckoo bananas with all the extra nonsense.
We get a little bit of extra nonsense here.
A little bit, but for the most part, it's pretty much just an adaptation of the cartoon. I mean, you get some extra characters in the house. You get some weird extra backstory with Belle's mom. But for the most part, that's just like expanding the runtime. It's not really distracting from the story. It's not really adding much either. I don't know. I mean, there was some stuff I kind of liked. Like the French party at the beginning, I guess. I don't know. I basically just thought this movie was about, like, Paul Ryan. Like, I'm really hoping that he turns away some witch at some point and just gets cursed. Because I know he will never find true love. And I don't know why I made this political, but...
okay.
You know, he's a prince. I don't know. Whatever. I mean, there was some... Yeah, I don't know. It was fine. It was... Like I said, it basically just made me want to watch the cartoon. It was mostly effective at just being a nostalgia machine.
Right, which is basically what it was created for. Was for people our age to go back and remember that they liked the original. And for people younger who never knew to... You know, catch that magic for the first time.
You know what, though? From judging from the audience that I saw the movie with, it totally worked for that. I mean, the audience was filled with young people. They were like into it, like applauding at the end.
Sure,
like they'd never seen the original.
Right. Probably half and half as far as that goes. I credit most of that, any of the success this movie has, with Howard Ashman's and Alan Menken's music. I think those songs are monumental. They push the story completely. And as clunky as this version of it is, I think those songs are the engine that keeps it moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of felt like a Broadway production of the cartoon.
Well, the cartoon is a Broadway production. And I don't want to make it sound like it's like, they can't do anything to it. But because that original movie is so singular and so complete the way it is, any addition or subtraction to it is just going to gum up or mess with the pacing. A lot of this, like, especially because it's done in non-animation, with the exception of the beast and the enchanted appliances or whatever.
Which, you know what, let's talk about that for a second. For a fucking second. So, whatever you want about this movie, quality-wise, like, it was fine. I don't know. But, like, could we have not done some prosthetics on the beast? Did he have to?
Yeah.
He looked so rendered and CGI'd, and I wasn't really into his new kissable lips version design. like when he was roaring and stuff, or just kind of stomping around in his Krampus castle. As a monstrous Krampus, he was fine. But he had, like, these weird little like harmless cat fangs that poked out from under his kissable lips, and it really bothered me. He's way too attractive for a beast, and he's way too CGI to believe he's real.
That's the big problem, and I think that's a big problem with the movie, or one of the big problems with the movie, is that this whole thing is a love story. You're supposed to believe in Belle and the Beast, and you're supposed to believe that there's a real arc there, and they really come to fall in love with each other. But I'm not feeling that, because I see Belle as a real human being, and I see this cartoon she's supposed to fall in love with. And like, even if, actually, if they just imported the 2D animation of the original Beast, I might have believed that more than the thing they created for this movie.
Yeah.
And
it was like he was Prince of the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, exactly. He was super cold and super, Uncanny Valley-ish. And it just, the love story never takes off because of that. And again, going back to the structure of the original, a lot of that stuff is told a lot of it's told in song, and a lot of it's moved in montage. And a lot of that stuff, the exposition stuff of you know, how they fall in love, you just accept because it's animation. Mm-hmm. In this movie, then I can see why they tried to fill the gaps a little bit with some of the backstory and all this stuff that's more just a lateral move. The love story never really happens there. And what feels archetypal and what feels sort of iconic in the original cartoon just sort of feels lazy and vague in the movie,
mm-hmm.
in the live action movie. I think mostly that it doesn't work. I think like I already said, whatever does work just comes from the fact that those songs are so great,
mm-hmm.
that it's hard not to love them again. Even that,
they're like, okay, what's going on with Emma Thompson and her weird Cockney accent? Tale as old as time. Jesus. Like, could we have not just...
I was okay with that.
Really? That bothered me. Mm-hmm. Like, could we have not just used Angela Lansbury's original audio? Could we have not just used all of their original audio? It was like... as far as the denizens of Uncanny Valley Castle go...
Yeah.
Like, their parts weren't really expanded. The only one that I felt like really... stood out to me was Ian, Sir Ian McKellen as Cogsworth, and maybe that's just because they gave his clock face an adorable little frown, and I really liked him.
See, I actually thought that if we're talking about CGI, I think the CGI for all the Enchanted stuff is fine, because you're dealing with textures that's like metal or wood.
Lumiere did not work for me, because he's like, again, and I think this kind of is where it gets problematic as a live action versus a cartoon.
Animated.
Is he's like touching all this stuff with his fire candle hands. And it's like, okay, as part of the spell that you just can't burn down the castle. Like, you're picking up, you're a fucking feather duster made out of feathers. And that didn't bother me in a cartoon. But as I'm seeing these textures in supposed real life, like, she should be ablaze.
I let my suspension of disbelief go for most of that.
I didn't care for the design of most of them. Like, Lumiere looked weird as this weird brass person. Again, the only character design I was really into was Cogsworth, because his little frown face was adorable.
Yeah. And you had Ian McKellen doing that, so he usually brings his A-game to whatever he's doing.
Yeah.
I would have actually liked to seen this be less like the cartoon. If we're, you know, as much as I love that, I feel like if you're going to go live action, and I agree, I don't want to see her become a sorceress or become like a warrior with a sword at the end. Like, I don't need that. And I think you could tell the nuts and bolts of Beauty and the Beast, I would really like to have seen what Bill Condon wanted to do with it, because I do think we get a little bit of that in like the expansion of LeFou, and they give him this whole character arc, this redemption story, which I don't, again, it's another lateral move.
Let's talk about that, because we talked about the controversy a little bit earlier. Yeah. The question I was asking myself was, because, you know, at the beginning, he's in love with Gaston, and he does have sort of a redemption arc, which I did appreciate that. And my question is, would LeFou's character, because they play it for laughs, would he still be funny if it was a heterosexual relationship? Like, if LeFou was a female, would that still be funny? Would him making eyes at these other girls saying, "Ladies, you don't have a chance," still be funny? And I don't know.
I mean, again, I that's why I say it neither does... It doesn't really do anything to the character. I mean, I can see... I think the fact that it becomes a redemption story saves that first half from just feeling like a gay clown face. Character. Yeah, like it keeps a
minstrel show.
Yeah, it keeps it from being. It makes it more into like there's a point to be made. I feel like this movie already has so much going on that we don't need that point made.
Mm-hmm. To me, the thing is, I don't. I think their problem was that they made such a big stink out of it. And I don't think it was necessarily Disney that did that.
But right, the fact right.
that it became a controversy drew way more attention to it than I think it needed.
Yeah, I think ultimately, you know, it's not that much more than what's already in the cartoon. So if people are really expecting, like, based off this conversation, they're going to get this whole LeFou thing. I mean, it's there, but it's not a huge deal. It doesn't. That's why I keep calling it a lateral move. It's just sort of more stuff. I feel the same way about all the addition of Belle's mother and living in France and like all that. Okay. Like, or living in Paris. Like, I feel like it's just kind of stuff. It's just to pad out the runtime to make it longer. And yeah, exactly. That's how I felt about this movie. Is it just kind of felt like the cartoon, but slower and longer, and not as effective.
I will say, everything about the movie. To summarize, my opinion of this movie was, it's fine. It's mm-hmm. basically like the cartoon, just not as good, with the exception of Luke Evans as Gaston.
Mm-hmm. I think he's one of the only ones who really got this.
Yeah. Yeah, and to me, they added just enough for it to be a little bit different from the cartoon, for it to really be his own character, but not so much that it was like, ugh, this is annoying. Like, it felt like the personal embodiment of Gaston, whereas nothing mm-hmm. else in the movie really felt like that to me.
Yeah, like, Luke Evans totally gets that voice down. Well, Luke Evans is a Broadway guy, originally. He's a song and dance man. He came from theater. So he understands that original tone that Howard Ashman and Alan Menken and all the people involved in the writing of the movie, the original movie, kind of got. So he can play Arch. Everybody else in the movie, even Kevin Klein, even especially Emma Watson, they're trying to naturalize it, and it doesn't work naturalized. The movie needs to be big. The movie needs to be this kind of big, campy whatever, and Luke Evans is the only one who kind of gets that.
Well, okay, I guess Josh Gad, his performance, but again, it works.
Also from Broadway.
Yeah, and it works, you know, so well with Luke Evans. You know, say what you will about the controversy. You know, they do have good chemistry. That song was one of the highlights. The Gaston song is one of the highlights mm-hmm. of the movie for me. So
I think Be Our Guest works. It's kind of a weird, like, multicolored sort of Las Vegas version of it. But I think that it at least captures that original energy.
No, see, I was so not into Lumiere that it kind of killed it for me. Like, to me, it was just mm-hmm. like, okay, like, that one was almost shot for shot the way it was in the cartoon. Mm-hmm. And to me, it just didn't really add anything but fake CGI and color. Whereas the Gaston song, fun chemistry between Luke Evans and Josh Gad. There's mm-hmm. blocking that they couldn't really do from the cartoon, so they had to substitute it with other, you know, blocking, and it felt like a Broadway production kind of moment.
Right.
Whereas Be Our Guest, to me, sort of embodied everything that didn't work with the movie, because it was just flashy, you know, it was just another version of a cartoon. Saying it's a live-action adaptation is like saying, you know, The Jungle Book is a live-action adaptation. No, it wasn't. There was a live-action boy, but literally everything else was still a cartoon, just a different type of cartoon.
Right, right, right. I agree on most points. This movie, it didn't offend me. I think, you know, it doesn't really touch the original, but whatever.
Yeah, I was more engrossed with it than I thought I would be, and I think it's just because I, like you said, the original's so good, and there's enough of that coming through that I was like, okay, at least I'm still, you know, watching, you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, totally.
But
let's go ahead and move on to Cleopatra, which you assigned me.
Yes.
Last week.
Mm-hmm.
This is a 4-hour movie. This is a, actually, technically, this is a 4-hour cut of a 3-hour and 12-minute movie.
Okay.
So we saw a longer version.
Technically, this is a 4-hour cut of a 3-hour cut, theatrical released, original 6-hour cut movie.
Yeah.
That never got released. So yeah. The 6-hour cut doesn't exist. But originally it was supposed to be 6 hours. I guess they actually were going to split it into 2 movies, which kind of makes sense. And actually, that was how we did it. And I think that's how you watched it as well. So the first half of the movie, it's a historical epic about the Queen of Egypt, Cleopatra, and her rise to power and romance with Julius Caesar is basically the first 2 hours. And then the second 2 hours is her romance and fall from grace with Mark Antony.
Yeah.
And I know what you're thinking. No, not the pop singer. The the Greek soldier. Roman soldier. Greek? Roman. Greek?
Roman.
Roman. The Roman soldier, Mark Roman Antony.
So this came... This came out in 1963, and I said something last week about how this, along with My Fair Lady, might have been part of the cause for the end of the classic era of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked a little bit into the numbers. I remember reading about this in school, but I wanted to get the numbers again. This was the highest grossing film of that year. And was nominated for all kinds of Academy Awards. Basically, everything it can be nominated for, it was nominated for. Got mixed reception, critically. Okay. But how does the movie that was the highest grossing film of 1963 cause the collapse of the Hollywood system?
Well, even though it was even though it was the highest grossing movie of 1963... it was also the most expensive movie of 1963 because they built all of these sets in London, I guess, and then found out they couldn't film there and had to tear everything down. And these sets are elaborate as fuck. And they had to tear everything down and rebuild everything, I guess, more on location. This is a spectacle. The sets are insane. The costumes are insane. The sheer numbers of extras are insane. I mean, this is back in the day when they couldn't CGI that kind of stuff either. Like,
no. And originally what you would do is you would build it all in a back lot, and you would have, you know, the first like 50 feet or something would be actual sets, and then you'd do the rest on a backlit drape or whatever.
Yeah, no, these
but
are...
here they use so much stuff on, so at least for the exteriors, they use so much for on location that they had to really build, you know, at least the facade of a lot of these old temples and ziggurats and whatever else.
Which is pretty insane when you consider that most of the movie is Cleopatra in her bedchambers, just sort of yelling at Julius Caesar and Mark Antony.
Yes, and that would kind of go into my overall take on the movie as a movie, you know, spectacle aside. Mm-hmm. The spectacle is very nice. I like a lot of the sets. I like the, you know, the 70mm size of the frame. I like looking at it a great deal. The costumes, all of that stuff. It's classic swords and sandals stuff from the 60s.
Yeah, if anyone's seen Hail Caesar, like, this is what they're making fun of.
This alongside, like, movies like The Robe and maybe a little bit of Ben-Hur, but yes. Mm-hmm. Certainly movies of this era. the movie itself is a lot of scenes of people in funny costumes talking to each other in accents. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty verbose, talky screenplay. And it's a 4-hour movie.
Yeah.
Of mostly people having heated arguments.
Exactly.
And for, you know, in between that, you get all the great sets and you get all the great, you know, there's a couple battle sequences. A lot of that stuff is really kind of brushed over.
You know what?
An exposition.
I was actually going to say, at the start of it, it is. Mm-hmm. I really feel like, so again, you can kind of, when you watch it, you can kind of see where the movie was supposed to be split. Mm-hmm. Because the first half is very much her and Julius Caesar and she gets pregnant and has his child, mm-hmm. and it's about that. It's about her birthing Caesar's heir, mm-hmm. and then the second half is, well, at least it starts with her, like, trying to protect his heir, and then, you know, that kind of gets forgotten about till the very end.
Right.
But there's a very clear delineation here, and to me, one of the movies worked and the other didn't. The stuff with Julius Caesar is a slog. It is real boring. It is mm-hmm. a real slow build to not much happening. And I just was not that into it. But then the second half, which is the more dramatic story, mm-hmm. is her love affair with Mark Antony. I was way more into. Again, it does have some of the same problems. I think they mm-hmm. could have cut, you know, 45 minutes of heated, passionate arguments out, and it'd still be a pretty entertaining movie. But to me, the second half was definitely more entertaining. There were some pretty cool set pieces, and there's some pretty mm-hmm. dramatic moments, especially near the end, that I was like, whoa, that's actually really cool. It's just a shame it took 3.5 hours to get here.
Right. And I mean, you know, the biggest set piece is the most famous one is the entrance of Cleopatra into Rome for the first time, and like the big procession and the big parade. You see that a lot when people talk about how expensive this movie was. I think most of the performances are really good. This is directed by Joseph Mankiewicz, not this kind of director usually. He usually did kind of more character-oriented stuff. And I think he likes actors, and I think he's really good with actors. A lot of these are classically trained British actors here. So they know how to do this sort of Shakespearean-ish dialogue. It's not Shakespearean exactly. It's not an iambic pentameter or anything, but it has that sort of stagey quality to it. Yeah. And I think they know how to speak in that really naturally.
Well, and Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, again, Mark Antony, mm-hmm. who would become her husband. They had a romance during the filming of this movie. To me, had a lot more mm-hmm. chemistry as well. Again, the guy who played Caesar is way older. Felt, you know, he was fine. He was a fine actor. He just, mm-hmm. I didn't think had as much chemistry. And when, again, half of your 4-hour movie is banking on this chemistry, and if that doesn't mm-hmm. really work, it's just kind of a ugh.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I felt like while I was watching the movie, the experience of watching it was I was kind of lulled in and out of it at times. Like there were certain periods, stretches of the movie where I was kind of losing interest. I was kind of getting bored. I was kind of like looking at Facebook or whatever. And then like all of a sudden a dramatic point would happen and I'd be like, oh, okay, this is actually kind of interesting. And really, I mean, given the fact that this was a 6-hour movie at one point, I feel like you could easily cut this into a hot hour 45.
I was going to say actually about the last hour, I think is mm-hmm. very tight. Mm-hmm. Like from the big sea battle on. Where Mark Antony, when they really show his character, and when he sort of, like, he faces this great defeat, and sort of gives up on life, and that stuff really worked for me. The sea battle was cool, especially from the 60s. I was like, man, this actually kind of kicks ass. And then his whole character arc from then on, I was like, okay, he's more than just this romantic lead. He's actually got some, like, complex stuff he's dealing with. And when he gives up on life and stuff, I'm, like, totally into it. And this, again, when she sort of rallies him to go face the Roman army, like, one last time. And I'm not worried about spoilers. It's from 1963 and it's 4 hours long. You're not going to watch it. when his troops desert him, it's genuinely pretty heartbreaking. Like, that moment really worked for me, where he's just alone in the desert and he just wants to be murdered by the Roman army.
Well, there's something to be said about, you know, doing a lot of legwork with the characters. I mean, this movie does more than most movies. Yeah. That it makes you invested in the drama.
Oh, for sure. I just think there was a little bit too much legwork. Like, we were talking about movies that could be remade. I was thinking, like, a modern version, if they use some of that stuff in a leaner script, could be very, very appealing to the Game of Thrones crowd. A lot of it kind of reminded me of that. I was like, man, George R. R. Martin definitely got some stuff from this.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, there's the overarching story about Cleopatra and her rise and fall, and then these Caesar's rise and fall, and Mark Antony's rise and fall, and sort of the romantic tragedy of it all. But then there's also the subplot of, you know, the Roman Senate and this, you know, buying and selling of land and the rising powers of, you know, one empire to another and all of that stuff. I guess the historical stuff. And some of that stuff.
And just like the rightful heir and yeah.
All that kind of senatorial drama. I think I appreciated it more than I liked it, especially on just the grandiosity of it and sort of the opulence. I can't say that I was terribly entertained for most of it until, like you said, the rubber hits the road. On the plot stuff. But I get both the criticisms of the movie and sort of why it's still something that people talk about.
Yeah, that's basically how I felt. I think I might have liked the 3-hour cut more. Like I said, I think I really think it could have just been that second movie, and all of the stuff with Julius Caesar they could have covered pretty quickly at the beginning, and just like I think that would have done a lot for me. Is had I not had to get through a whole 2-hour movie just to get through this other 2-hour movie that's kind of slow at the start and then gets pretty good at the end.
Right. Okay. Well, next week, I didn't talk to you about this before, but have you seen the movie Frailty?
Oh my God.
What?
I was thinking about picking that. I mean, not this week, because this week is your choice, but like, I was thinking about, like, next week, maybe making that my choice.
Okay, well, then I guess that's... Now, you haven't seen it before, have you?
No, I haven't. That's why I wanted to watch it. I was like, that's in my list currently.
Good.
Has that ever happened before?
Yeah, it'll happen every once in a while.
Fine.
So, Frailty is the only movie that Bill Paxton, the late Bill Paxton, directed.
Oh, I didn't know he directed.
And it's always a movie I've heard about being cool or whatever, so I'm interested in it. Kind of a horror thriller.
Yeah. No, I'm down.
And that's what we'll end up talking about that next week. We got a letter.
What?
We got a letter. It's from Patrick.
Oh. I mean, I'm sorry, Patrick. I'm still excited.
Well, you should be excited because this is almost just a big hand job to you. So just get ready for all the adoration here from Patrick.
Okay.
He says, gentlemen, excellent past few shows. Keith, for an episode or two, I was like, who is this fucking guy? Improv? Now I understand that I'm from the Rust Belt area, that is not Chicago, so improv is a strange concept. yet, you won my heart with the past few shows, and here is how. And he numbered these. Number one, Naughty Pope is now in my lexicon, even when not discussing the show. number two, I agree, grade the films, even if Cassidy is uncomfortable, which we didn't do, by the way. Should we do that right now?
Yeah.
What do you give Beauty and the Beast?
Beauty and the Beast, I'd give a C+.
I think I gave it the same thing. Maybe a C-. I'm not sure. I'd have to go look again. And then Cleopatra? I don't know.
I'd give it a B-.
I'd give it a C+. Okay. You explain Legion as well as any human can without sounding as if you're mainlining Monster Energy drinks, watching Dragon Ball Z on a loop, and editing wiki pages 19 hours a day.
That's the best compliment I've ever received in my entire life.
And he says, your summary of Mark Millar is very much my own. He has so many great concepts, and 90% of them hit home perfectly, but the other 10% are weird shit and rapey jokes from 4chan.
Yeah. He really needs an editor.
Yeah. And then he says, number five, this is not so much something, this is not so much something about you. I just wanted to number five. my future wife also yells at people during the film. She yells at every human and animal at some point during Kong yesterday. So they watched King Kong, him and his fiance. And then he says, Cassidy, you and I have podcasted often, and I'm sorry, but there's another gushing email about the other half. You are the glue that holds the show, blah, blah, blah. He compliments me because he knew so much of this was about you.
I like how uncomfortable you got when it came to reading your own compliment. Thank you very much, Patrick, for A, listening. It's nice to know this isn't entirely in a vacuum. I don't know. You seem like a cool dude.
We'll have him on eventually.
He's officially my Naughty Pope of the Week.
There you go. We'll have him on eventually again for one of these comic book movies or something.
There's a few coming out.
I'm sure there are.
Have you seen the trailer for Spider-Man?
No, not yet.
All right.
I'm sure I'll see it 16 times in the theater before I see the movie itself. Okay, so that's the show. That's the week. And I don't have my show notes, so I'm going to try and think of things. You can follow me at BC Cassidy on Twitter. You can follow the show at Jabber Podcast on Twitter. You can find the show at jabberthedrone.podbean.com. That's where our RSS feed is. We're also on Stitcher, iTunes, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. What else? I write reviews. You can read those at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. My review for Raw was published by the MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And you have stuff too.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Find me on Facebook and send me a like or a follow, and I'll appreciate that. Just at Keith Foster, I guess. I don't have a personal, it's just my personal profile, but I'm a nice dude. Also, check out my show Tonight in San Diego. Go to tonightinsandiego.com. Follow it on Twitter and Instagram at Tonight in San Diego. We actually got some sad news in regards to Tonight in San Diego. We were on the CW6. CW6 mm-hmm. got bought out. They announced the buyout almost immediately after we announced that we got picked up. And apparently the new channel does want to start with a totally clean slate. So it sounds like we will not be moving over to the new channel. So please check us out on YouTube. The more you watch our videos, the more it helps the show. Also, check it out on Facebook. Hopefully, we'll be on TV again soon. I'm sure it won't be too long, but it's kind of a bummer. So in the meantime, check us out online, because it really does help keep us credible and to keep us, you know, on doing what we're doing, which is a shame because I feel like this season we've really hit our stride. It's the show, you know, it's changed a lot even since I've joined. But I have a great time with the host, Jesse Egan, and I just feel like this season we've really kind of figured out sort of our chemistry and stuff. So sort of a bummer to hear that we won't be on, you know, primetime late night TV anymore, but we're still going to keep doing what we're doing. So yeah, check us out. It helps.
Cool. Listen to our friends who also do podcasts. The Listening Party just released their new episode, and we were on there a couple weeks ago, and that was a lot of fun. So you should listen to them. Adjacent to the Listening Party, the Mascot Diaries, and then Patrick's two shows, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. I never really plugged them as much, but I've been recently dipping back into the Great Albums podcast. Bill and Brian over there, I've been on one of their episodes. They talked about Is This It by the Strokes, and I just listened to their episode about Rain and Blood by Slayer and Songs for the Deaf by Queens of the Stone Age, and I think they're only getting better and better, and their guests are getting more and more famous. So, yeah, check them out. Tripod. All right, I think that's it.
Cool. Give it to Gosling.